The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm Director of Author Events. And I'm very pleased that all of you decided to disregard the predictions and the lousy weather and come out. I think it will prove worth the risk. Before we meet Dr. Dyson, I'd like to introduce his interviewer, Dr. James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies and Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. Dr. Peterson is a contributor to MSNBC, as well as the founder of Hip Hop Scholars, Inc., an association of hip-hop generational scholars dedicated to researching and developing the cultural and educational potential of hip-hop urban and youth cultures. He's also the host of Remix on WHYY. Please welcome Dr. James Peterson.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Andy, and I want to thank all the staff and all the folks here at the Philadelphia Free Library. It's always great to do these community events, so I appreciate this opportunity to be here and the opportunity actually to be in dialogue with one of our great writers and thinkers in the 21st century. Michael Eric Dyson is a writer. He is the author of Reflecting Black in 1993, Making Malcolm in 1995, Race Rules in 1996, Between God and Gangster Rap in 1997, I May Not Get There With You, The True Martin Luther King in 2000. Holler If You Hear Me, Searching for Tupac Shakur in 2002. Open Mic, Reflections on Philosophy, Race, Sex, Culture, and Religion in 2002. Why I Love Black Women, New York in 2002. The Michael Eric Dyson Reader in 2004. Is Bill Cosby Right or Has the Black Middle Class Lost Its Mind in 2005. Pride, The Seven Deadly Sins in 2006. Come Hell or High Water, Hurricane Katrina and the Color of Disaster in 2006. Debating Race in 2007. Know What I Mean, Reflections on Hip Hop in 2007. April 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King's Death and How It Changed America in 2008. Can You Hear Me Now in 2009. Born to Use Mics in 2010, and so on and so on. Michael Eric Dyson is a writer, all right? Michael Eric Dyson is also a university professor. For folks who are not familiar with how ranking works in the academy, a university professor is the highest rank that an individual academic can achieve at any institution of higher learning. He is a university professor at Georgetown. We miss him here in Philadelphia. For those of you who know Dr. Dyson, you might miss the UPenn days when he was around our city a little bit more. He is now in D.C. At the fine institution of Georgetown, where he teaches sociology and he teaches religion studies courses as well as pop cultural courses. I've had many opportunities to visit Dr. Dyson's courses, and he's one of the most electric and most compelling professors I have had an opportunity to meet. Michael Eric Dyson is also a political analyst for MSNBC, and he appears on multiple networks talking about issues ranging from race and politics to pop culture and social justice. But one of the things that folks don't often know about this great figure, this incredible thinker, intellectual, political commentator, and writer, is that he is also an extraordinary mentor. He mentors scores of young people all over this country and has done so for the better part of his career. And he has engaged in the youth activist movements of the moment. So in addition to being a very prolific writer, in addition to being an incredible scholar and a professor, in addition to being one of the most gifted political analysts, he is also an ordained minister. Michael Eric Dyson can be seen preaching from any pulpit across this nation on any given Sunday. And so the collection or the conflation of all those incredible skills and all the work that he does in the community gives me great pleasure to also call him my friend. He is a dear friend, and I cherish our relationship more than I can express to you right now. But tonight, we are here to talk about his most recent work, an amazing book entitled The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race. I hope that our conversation this evening will not only compel you to go out and purchase the book, but also go out and tell all your friends about this. This book is going to go down in history as the most sustained rhetorical reflection on the rhetoric of the first black presidency. And as such, I think it will be one of the more important books written about this president in history. So without further ado, it gives me great pleasure and it is a humble honor to introduce my dear friend, Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. I wanted to list out the books because so often when I see or hear you introduced, they say he's the author of 18 books or author of 19 books. And I think it's important for people to understand the catalog and to see the full range, but also the prolific nature of the release of those books into the 21st century. It's an amazing body of work that you have, sir.
Thank you.
Amazing body of work. Now, you know, I have all my tabs here, and I have a lot of questions, but we do want to also open this up at some point in the evening. So I think there are a lot of things I want you to kind of break down, a lot of concepts I want you to break down from the book. But I first want to start with the discourse that the book has generated. So I think I've read every review. I think I've read every review. And I'm not completely convinced that the reviewers so far, and you've gotten some good reviews. You've had a full range, some outstanding reviews, some critical reviews, right? I'm not completely convinced that the reviewing class has captured the sense of the book. So I wonder if we could just start by you thinking with us a little bit about what you're trying to achieve overall with this book. What contribution from your perspective is this book supposed to make in the discourse on the first black president?
Right. Well, I want to, first of all, express my gratitude for the Free Library for hosting us here again. Brother Andy has been our friend over many, many years, as Professor Peterson and I have come here. And what a great audience, and thank you all for coming out during the snow and the snow job in New Hampshire. But it's and I want to thank my very dear friend, Professor James Peterson. When we were first coming here, he was finishing up as a graduate student. Now he's a big-time MSNBC political analyst, famous. People stop him in the street. We went to a basketball game in Detroit. I couldn't even get to my seat because they're getting his autograph and taking pictures. I said, oh, that's what that feels like. That's okay. And incredible work as the director of Africana Studies at Lehigh. So let's give him a little love up in here tonight as well. what I wanted to do is to take measure of the expanse, the magnitude, the depth of who Barack Obama is, what he represents, and looking at him specifically through the lens of race. How race has shaped our perception of him, how it has given us a sense of what his possibility is, what his goals are, what his objectives are, what the range of his imagination might mean to a nation that has been dismissive of its black underbelly upon which it rests, but doesn't often acknowledge. And I wanted to also talk about the degree to which race has been used to characterize and curtail his presidency and shape in public perception what it is that he is ultimately about. And I wanted to also look at the ways in which Obama uses race himself and sometimes avoids it and deflects it in deference to other ideas. So I wanted to do that while acknowledging his genius, his incredible contribution to the culture, but also his limitations and failures.
Yeah, I want to come back to the race piece probably multiple times in the conversation. But another sort of broader question, you know, one of the themes that comes up quite a bit in the text is, you know, you're both making the case for principled critique, right? And you're also performing, I think, principled critique. But I'm not sure if everyone understands the larger discourse around that. And so can you define for us what is principled? Because I think, again, you're making the case for that you can engage this president based on principal critique, and that it will have a more generative effect. But you're also performing that, so that your critique here are based on a range of principles, but many of them have to do with history, have to do with the civil rights generation, have mm-hmm. to do with sort of race theory and the presence of race in America. But talk to us a little bit about what you mean by principled critique, and what's the sort of larger discourse here of principled versus unprincipled critique of the first black president?
Yeah, you've brilliantly laid that out. You gave me a way to think about that in the future. In future talks, I will commandeer that categorization you made. Well, look, principled critique for me is the striving to assess as objectively as possible. None of us can be neutral, right? We all have our biases and our bigotries and our particular commitments and our loyalties, which are either stated or unstated. We have a particular lens through which we view the world. The observer effect in physics operates in social theory as well, that the instrument that divines a particular presence or energy itself begins to shape that energy and our perception of it. So I'm fully invested in self-awareness at that level without trying to make myself the story. The critic inevitably comes into play. But in this sense, principled critique is about acknowledging what the limits of such analysis are, and to apply to President Obama in this case the most rigorous and yet satisfyingly balanced understanding of the factors that have shaped him, what he's up against, and then ask a question of his culpability or at least accountability in the midst of that. So principled critique is not calling him names, not dogging him out, not calling him a, you know, mascot, not saying that he's a horrible human being, a priori going into the door, you just know whether he's good or bad. It's allowing the resonance and residue of the facts to impress us through the narrative interpretation we offer. And what I'm trying to offer here is an understanding of Obama in relationship to what his goals and objectives are and how he achieved them, and according to the big idea of race that is so powerful in this culture and yet often, I think, misunderstood when it comes to him. So for me, principled critique is not only about holding him accountable in ways that are not unfair, in ways that are not ad hominem, but in ways that appeal to, as you said, some of the principles of scholarship. Can we investigate what he's about without overdoing either the negativity of approach or the positivity of presumption? How do we come out with a balanced understanding of who he is? Some people think, oh, man, and I've been accused of all of it, so maybe right. I've done my job. Right. I've been accused of you hater, right. You're a Taylor Swiftian, you know, haters gonna hate. On the other hand, I've been accused of being an uncritical Obama bot who's supportive of this president no matter what. And especially for black people, if I may, it's been difficult to engage in any kind of sustained criticism. Now, white liberals have a particular species of resistance, but that has to do with the efficacy of Obama in the long run toward goals and objectives that they've already realized aren't perfect, but heck, it's better than what it was. Black people have that, plus the fact this is the first black president. You know,
symbolic piece.
Symbolic piece is heavy. White Americans have had 43. We got one. Well, and many of my white brothers and sisters tell me, hey, he's half us, you know.
Right. We got half.
So that's right. Right. They got 43 and a half presidents.
Right, we got the point.
And we got half a brother.
Right.
So we working with that half. Mm-hmm. We are dealing with the algebra of the presidency in fractions. So the thing is, black people like, look, leave that brother alone. Yeah. It's hard enough to get up in the morning and do what he does. And what I try to say to black people, look, you know, Obama is, to me, like Shaquille O'Neal, right? Shaquille O'Neal is a great player. Obama's a great president. Great player. The man has 4 rings. Kobe has 5, therefore superior. But, I mean, what did Snoop say? The West Coast ain't got no love. The East Coast ain't got no love for Snoop. Y'all, Marion? Lower Marion? Yeah, this is local, homeboy. Show some love for Kobe.
Let's stay away from Kobe.
Show some love for Kobe. But anyway. So thank you for that smattering of applause. Your books shall be signed first. So Shaq was a great player.
Right.
But he couldn't make free throws. And when telling the story of Shaq, if you insist upon redoing history by saying Shaq was a great foul shooter, you are distorting history. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, Shaq's poor foul shooting impacted the game.
Right.
Thus, they came up with Hack-a-Shaq. Mm-hmm. It was his vulnerability, mm-hmm. and they exploited it. Mm-hmm. Obama, in my mind, will go down as one of the greatest presidents we've had. He rescued the economy. Yeah. He rescued the banks. Yeah. He gave us health care, and he bailed out the automobile industry in the first 2 years.
Man.
But there were some failures, too, the drones, the kill list. The failure to withdraw from Guantanamo, but though not exclusively his problem, or at least responsibility.
But his racial but free throws.
The racial free throws Obama didn't make, and he was hack-a-Obama, hack-a-Shaq, because he failed to attempt. And when he did, they were often like Shaq's out of whack and poorly executed. Except, where my analogy breaks down, Shaq was a poor a free throw shooter, but Obama, by writing his memoir and his second book, proved
showed
to be
that he could do it.
Excellent with race and knew about it. So for me, when I ask black people, is there anything that you're willing to be critical of Obama of? And if you're not, your loyalty may be good in terms of a personal connection to a historic and symbolic figure, but it does less well when it comes to an analysis of who Obama is. And all I ask is for fairness and balance.
Okay, that's awesome. I am not going to like spoil all the amazing turns of phrase and analogies that you have in here. Spoiler alert, I'm going to do one right now, but I'm not going to do that. There are some brilliant analogical passages here, some incredible metaphors, extended metaphors, and similes here. I have them all marked, but I won't.
English professor. That's what English professors do.
But I do want to read one here because I think this is, I want to hear your response to this. You say here that Barack Obama is not the first black person capable of being president. He is the first black person to get a chance to prove it. When it comes to opportunity, it is a two-way street. They, black people, should certainly do all they can to succeed, and they, white people, should do all they can to remove barriers to success. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I want you to respond to that is because it's an enduring theme in the black presidency that Obama, much like his biracial heritage, is split in trying to sort of politically appease what he perceives is his white constituency and what he perceives is his black constituency. And so can you talk a little bit more about that two-way street? How's that, you know, how's that realized in the world? What do folks, how can we sort of operationalize that brilliant metaphor?
No, well, thank you for that. And as an English professor, you know, you're digging deep, and I certainly appreciate that. Like the hidden track on albums, I've tried to put nuggets in there that people who will dig deep enough will discover. Mm-hmm. So thank you for discovering that one. But, you know, look, it is a problem. It is a contradiction. It is an essential bifurcation of the American soul, race is. Mm. And instead of seeing Obama as a person who's trying to deal with the division, he is the division. Mm-hmm. Like integrated into his body is the attempt to overcome in his blood and genes what the nation has been incapable of overcoming with its sociology and its anthropology. Mm-hmm. That Obama has overcome or attempted to in bringing together black and white. Now, I know that there are many more divisions in this country with its resonant conceptions of diversity and difference, and I acknowledge that. But still in all, the black-white divide has been the major artery through which the blood of bigotry has flowed throughout the body politics.
See what I mean?
For the balance of our history. So for me, Obama appeals to his biracialism consciously and offers it to America. David Remnick made this point. To a degree in his magisterial biography of Obama, that Obama's biracialism is appealed to by him and others as the basis for his being able to speak to all constituencies, black and white. Mm-hmm. I must say, on that two-day street that you pointed to, he's done a far better job of speaking to his white constituency mm-hmm. than to his black one, ironically. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic for a couple of reasons. First of all, because he's seen as black even by most white people,
right.
even though he's acknowledged as biracial. But when you look at him, the phenotype and the genotype are in a little bit in tension. Mm-hmm. So you look at him, anybody gonna think, oh, he's Caucasian, mm-hmm. or he has Caucasoid features, or you know that somehow his whiteness, his European heritage, mm-hmm. is manifest. He's darker than a lot of people who ain't got no biracial heritage. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. so in that sense, it's a test of one's eye. It's an ophthalmological feat, but at a deeper level, it's interesting because Obama's shaping in a womb of whiteness. Is pretty remarkable and pretty durable. Mm-hmm. You know, his mother, when she was rearing him in Hawaii, then when he went to live with his grandparents in Kansas, mm-hmm. then when he embarked upon kind of global travels to Indonesia where they lived for a while and the like. Obama has been profoundly shaped by a dominant white culture in many interesting and I think sometimes detectable fashion, but sometimes not. So for me, when we break down that two-day street, I think Obama has played to his understanding of what white people fear. He mm-hmm. showed that in his famous race speech up the road here
right.
at Constitution Hall. He has never, except one time, pressed white people mm-hmm. as white people. He's mm-hmm. pressed them in terms of subcategories, mm-hmm. whether you're conservative or whether you're somebody's part of the birther, and even there he's been gentle. Mm-hmm. But one time when he was running, the first time around in a Tony fundraiser in San Francisco when he said, and Sarah Palin nailed this and parodied this the other day, about our gun clinging, plum slinging. I mean, she was spitting lyrics. There Miss Palin was, MC Palin. Obama said, you know, when some members of the dominant white culture get into a little mm-hmm. crisis, they cling to their guns, they get bitter, their religion. And white folk beat him down and let him know that is not acceptable
right.
in this country. He stopped. Black people have never offered a similar response to the president, except in small pockets. Mm-hmm. And so in response to his ability to at length excoriate black people and lecture them. So that two-way street is important because they, black people, must acknowledge whatever responsibility we have as citizens of this country, regardless of our circumstance, to edify ourselves and do the best we can. But white brothers and sisters have an equal responsibility to remove barriers, those who are in power. Mm-hmm. I mean, those who have the ability to make a difference. And even those who share in white privilege beyond the vaunted celebration of the higher echelons of politics or culture. You don't have to be a rich white person to enjoy white privilege. Mm-hmm. If you're walking down the street and a police person stops you and you reach for your wallet and the policeman doesn't assume it's your gun, that's the most precious form of white privilege ever because you're allowed to exist, mm-hmm. right? So for me, I think that kind of privilege is something that has to be taken into account, and the president has failed to reinforce that. And some of my black brothers and sisters who clapped at my acknowledgement of that form of white privilege would defend Obama for not calling it out.
Right.
That's the irony
right. that's
we
the
have.
Complexity of
that,
it.
That's the irony
or
and
be
the complexity.
Mad at you for calling it out.
And be mad at me.
Right, right.
I'm
right,
just
right,
doing
right.
my job. Yeah.
So
remember.
So there is a lot of Martin Luther King in this mm-hmm. in this text. Obviously, you know, I can feel you wrestling with Obama possibly supplanting MLK mm-hmm. As the greatest American and or greatest black American in mm-hmm. history. And I feel you very resistant to that.
Oh, yeah.
In the text, even though you concede that it's almost a foregone conclusion that because of what he's achieved and who he is, Obama will in some ways outstrip MLK, which I feel a little bit of your pain in the text.
I'm bleeding on that one.
You are. And so one of the ways that seeps out in the text is is you kind of show us a little bit of King's radicalism, but also force us to read Obama over and against King. And so I want you to think about two pieces here. One, where you talk about King endorsing democratic socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want you to talk about that in the context of the contemporary moment and where you see Obama. Obviously, we have a presidential candidate now who claims the Democratic Socialism
right.
moniker. You know, what's the status of, what is it and what's the status of it in the contemporary moment? And mm-hmm. then the sort of second piece here is, you quote King in 1967 as saying, "I am sorry to have to say that the vast majority of white Americans are racist, either consciously or unconsciously."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important piece because, again, the question is President Obama someone who has benefited from King's legacy, aware of that fact?
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, I'm curious as to whether or not you think that statement by King, again, in the contemporary moment, still holds true.
Wow. Man. See, I'm glad that the reviewers didn't read all of my book because they'd have been pressing these issues and I might not have been prepared to answer. Let me first of all speak to your very deft deconstruction of my King displacement fear. And it's not so
is
much...
That fair, is that a fair assessment?
It's a fair assessment. Okay. And I try to be fair to Obama in here because, you know, the haters who have tried to dismiss him, the guy is huge.
Yeah.
He had an idea that no black person in the history of this world has ever successfully maintained. I want to run the greatest democracy, the most powerful nation in the history of this world.
Mm.
And I'm a black man. Others have had that desire. Ain't nobody been able to achieve it. So hats off to him at that level. And those of us who would dare criticize him haven't been in that job, and we don't know.
Right.
Right.
Meaning we don't know what he has to deal with every day when he wakes up. We're
right.
not aware of how many death threats he gets on a 24-hour cycle, things of that nature.
And still be cool with it.
Right. Right.
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
No, we won't.
Yeah.
No. Fine. I mean, Doc, that's amazing. But for me, still, I guess it's the Baptist preacher in me. I may not get there with you.
Yeah.
You know, they're both great, but here's the difference. Then we got into Memphis. That separates the wheat from the tare. Because, like Albert Camus said, you want to be that great, you got to die and rise up on the third day.
Mm.
Now, ain't many of us trying to be that great,
right?
Mm-hmm. Martyrdom can sweep away the cobwebs of contradiction.
Mm.
It can resurrect a person who was near death, and King was.
Mm-hmm.
He was symbolically and in some instances rhetorically and certainly racially dead in a certain way before he was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
10 Most Admired Americans list eluded him for the first time in a decade. Many black people thought he was a slow-talking black preacher. Get out the way, you're irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
To imagine where Martin Luther King Jr. was then, imagine where Jesse Jackson is now.
Mm.
And Jesse Jackson I love and is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of objective analysis of where he has gone,
mm-hmm.
Imagine where King, in a sense, that's where King was.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he was assassinated, the mud thrown at him was then replanted in the earth, and from it sprang King's kind of cosmic status.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that bit. And the great, in this sense, what King did can produce an Obama. What Obama has done could never produce a King. So in that sense, I would argue that King is generative in the way you used it earlier. Let me just say this. So let me answer your question. So in terms of democratic socialism, isn't it interesting? You know, love Bernie Sanders. I mean, my man's out there doing his thing. But this is the former white privilege on the left. Obama got pilloried.
Right.
He's a communist. He's a socialist.
Right.
He's a Muslim. Right? This dude, if he looked like he was going to say the S word, except Superman.
Right.
And Cam Newton didn't have much success with that.
Mm.
What's up, Cam? And so now...
Bernie Sanders can go out
Bernie
and say,
Sanders
I'm a
can go straight
socialist.
Up. I'm a socialist.
Right.
I'm a democratic socialist.
And he's winning New Hampshire
and
right now.
I'm winning New Hampshire right now.
Right.
And Hillary is taking money off of Wall Street and he's pushing her.
Right.
I mean, if that's not white privilege right there up in your face in a way that the black man, who ain't no socialist, by the way.
Right.
First of all, he can't say it because he ain't it.
Right.
He's a moderate Democrat,
right.
Which means he should be more amenable and acceptable and loved by the vast majority of people, but it has eluded him.
Mm.
So, and democratic socialism is simply the belief that not the means of production should be owned by the state. That's not what democratic socialism is about. It's about the vast redistribution of wealth in a country that has redistributed the wealth upward. Mm-hmm. It is to reverse that trend, to reintroduce a conception of democratic and egalitarian capital, where that capital is generated and distributed toward those who most need it.
And who earn it and who, through labor.
Who earned it through labor. And look, how can black people be lazy when they work for free for a long time? Like for like 300 and some years, right? So, but here's the point. And Ta-Nehisi Coates put this on, and a lot of people thought it was a trick, put this on Bernie Sanders, when he said, here you are, democratic socialist, willing to go beyond the pale, as Barney Fife would say, beyond the ken of mortal man. Mm-hmm. You're willing to go out there and become a democratic socialist, but, oh, reparations, that's too radical.
Right.
Okay, because it's black, and it's blackened, so that race continues to make a difference even among democratic socialists. Mm. See, that famous story that Derek Bell told me when we were on a panel together at the Socialist Scholars Conference. Mm-hmm. And when we were speaking, and he told the story of a black man in Harlem, and the communists came to Harlem to recruit.
Yeah.
And then they were giving him all, hey, communists are better, you know, he's racist and bigots. And then he said, the black man asked, after all the spiel, he said, Mr. Communist, can I ask you a question? Yes. After the revolution, will you still be white?
Mm.
He said, oh, okay. Because whiteness has its own kind of logic that almost transcends whatever particular variety of ideology you share. Mm-hmm. Oscars So White is an ostensible liberal Hollywood. Mm-hmm. This is not Fox News. Mm-hmm. Fox News got more black people on TV than the Oscars on the liberal side got on the Oscars.
Mm.
Man, So my point is this, that in regard to the second point you made, when Dr. King said, it pains me to acknowledge most Americans, whether consciously or not, are racist, he doesn't simply mean bigot. See, we personalize everything. Mm-hmm. There are structural factors that allow people to prevail and to flourish, and others that keep people from prevailing and flourishing. And King is both acknowledging the temptation and seduction to believe in a certain kind of understanding of what blackness is and what black people do, mm-hmm. versus the kind of structural issues. He meant both.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, Obama himself shares in some of those beliefs. And it, ironically enough, Obama can't even be called on the kind of white privilege that he puts forth, because if he's biracial, mm-hmm. some of that white privilege has seeped into him in a very interesting and fascinating fashion.
I can't believe that Andy just gave me the signal that I only have one question left when I have like 1,000 questions left.
Let the people speak. No, I'm sorry. Okay. I'll never get invited. Can we do another hour and then we'll have... No, okay.
But I'm going to...
Andy's paying the bills, bro.
I'm going to fold a few questions into one for you, okay? I mean, the long and the short of it is I want you to think a little bit or talk to us a little bit about... the theme of black patriotism and the distinction you make between black patriotism and black nationalism in the text, right?
Yeah.
And the sort of perils of rhetoric, because what we haven't had a chance to really dig into is the deep and thoughtful rhetorical analysis that you perform in the text. And so here's some notes I want you to think about as you try to answer the question about black patriotism. And the perils of rhetoric. You know, one of the pieces of this rhetorical analysis is, and you do this brilliant transition from the souls of black folk to talking about Obama being the scold of black folk. And I can remember after the first election, one of my great friends, his name is Zaid Abdul Alim, he called me up. And, you know, there was so much energy and excitement after he was arrested. And you talk about this.
Yes.
But he calls me up. And this is a good brother. He's from Chicago. He comes from humble means. And he just goes into this long rant. He's like, JP, you know, no black person, no young black man from anywhere can any longer have any excuses for anything. Right? And it's so interesting. He was saying it in such a celebratory way.
Sure.
Right? And I feel like he believed that. And I think in some ways, Obama drinks that Kool-Aid a little bit.
Right.
You talk about that in your sort of rhetorical analysis. But another thing that happened in that same moment is that when Obama won, I was living in Central PA and I was my whole family, just me and my kids and my wife, we're sitting there and we're watching him come out to accept. This is an incredible moment. It's like, you know, everyone has tears in their eyes. Mm-hmm. It's really powerful. And my son, when he sees Obama come onto the stage, he was younger then. He gets really scared. He starts to cry, and he's like, is somebody going to shoot him? Is somebody, you know, he has a fear, literally, right? That, and he's apoplectic. And I literally had to bring him closer to the screen to show him the bulletproof panes of glass so that he would calm down, right? And in the book, you talk about this. There are black people who initially won't even vote for him for fear of the fact that he will be assassinated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want you to use those anecdotes to think a little bit about black patriotism, right? Mm-hmm. And also the perils of rhetoric, because obviously you're probably a little bit more critical of him on his rhetoric than you are. You when he's good, you're like, because this is about rhetoric around how he deals with race. You, when he's good, you applaud him and talk about all
I
the beautiful things.
I end my book with the
you
amazing
end the book
grace.
On a very high note. And when he's a scold, you call him out as such. But that the part of I think what Obama is dealing with is the fear that my son had when he first saw him walk out to say the uncontrollable sense of the dangers of being the first black president,
right.
But also the elation of a black community that then says they take the symbolic piece of it to the extreme.
Right.
I have one of my closest friends saying there's no more excuses for black people at all. Yeah. So how do you, talk a little bit about how you navigate those
yeah,
pieces in the book.
Yeah, that's so great. Your summary, again, I'm going to go back and read that book. That's, Jesus. Yeah. I think you read more than I wrote, and that's great. I love that, man. This guy's brilliant, huh? He's brilliant. Yeah, he is. That's, whew. You know, and I want to say this before answering the point, because I don't want Andy, I mean, you know, it's my man back there, Andy. You know, doesn't it make you then, knowing that black people, and your friend wasn't alone.
He's not, no.
I was on the Today Show the day after Obama won,
yeah.
And Matt Lauer's asking me literally that point about no more excuses.
No more excuses.
You know? And so, but doesn't that suggest that there's no need for the scolding because most black people already believe ain't no excuse.
That's right.
And black folk is out of their minds with that.
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
Beautifully said. And you point, you know, I'm saying that in euphemism and in a little bit of humor. Hmm. I'm saying because this is the beauty of black people, collectively speaking, that we say no more excuses because one man has now shifted the weight of the universe, racially speaking,
mm-hmm.
with such powerful forces at bay that this seismic event, to shift metaphors,
mm-hmm.
right, both ground and the orbit of the universe,
right.
This man has sent the world reeling off of its axis because of his election, which I was there in Grant Park.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, it was monumental.
The most collective emotional outpouring I've ever seen, maybe in my life.
When they said that this man is the president, it's still mm-hmm. amazing, right?
It is.
Still amazing that the hurt and trauma endured, the slave shipped, and the whip of the overseer, the rawhide whip, as King quoted Howard Thurman,
mm-hmm.
the ceaseless rows of cotton, the withering and unforgiving sun, Jim Crow that rent asunder the fabric of black existence, the spoiling of black psyches under the harsh tutelage of white supremacy, the refusal to acknowledge the humanity of black flesh, the reduction of black genius to a kind of calculated anti-human animalism mm. that only luckily rises to the level of art. Mm. That all of that was somehow for a moment suspended, and the better angels of our nature in that Lincolnian phrase was capable of seizing the collective imagination of this nation, and for a moment we were enthralled with the idea that democracy had finally issued its best-tasting fruit, that this black man is now president. Mm. And so you're right. I mean, I was moved by that, touched by that. But the point you make about the tension between black patriotism and the perils. I love how you put that, the perils of rhetoric and the rhetorical, because black folk have been committed to this country from day one.
Yep.
Right? We look, let me tell you something, and I don't mean there's any disrespect to any group of people, but when we were getting shat upon, if I can say that, if Donald Trump gives us permission to use the past tense in ways that are less accessible, if black America in the midst of it ain't dropped no bombs, ain't blown nobody up, ain't burnt nobody's cribs down, ain't done a whole lot of stuff that others, feeling rightfully damaged and traumatized by certain practices of America, have sought to do different things. We didn't do that. And our humanity was vouchsafed in those gestures of disciplined moral restraint from engaging in. Now, it's also practical. King said, look, you know, it ain't many of y'all, it's a bunch of them, it's gonna go down like faux flat tires. But so that's real, but it doesn't keep us from imagining we can have a Django Unchained moment. That's why I love that film. So for me, the black patriotism thing is quite interesting as you raise it up, because black people have always been committed to this nation. Here we are putting on a uniform to go defend what we can't even enjoy back home.
That's right.
Right? And when we get back, lynched.
That's right.
Because we dare wore that uniform to protect the right of bigots to murder us. Mm. So, and in one sense, the full arc of equality and the resplendent trajectory of our moral disposition was begging America to allow us to help them. Mm. Let me bless you with my Toni Morrison genius and my John Coltrane genius and my Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan genius. Let me bless you with the intellect that we can bring to bear. And we had to beg America to hear us so we could heal them, collectively speaking, right? I'm saying as a nation. So,
and that's why black patriotism is so important to
black
the
Black patriotism is so important. And it also, however, holds accountable the American nation.
Right.
See, that's why when Jeremiah Wright is in church, black people ain't hating America.
Right.
When he says, no, not bless goddamn America, he doesn't literally mean to damn America to
right.
hell, because he live here too.
Right.
Black folk ain't never been on that project of throwing nothing down and burning. Hey, I'm in it too.
Right.
Slow down with that, Mose.
But
slow
down with that. He's radically holding America to account.
Yeah. You know, James Baldwin said, I love America more than any nation on earth.
That's why I critique it.
I have the responsibility to critique it relentlessly. So that's the kind of love. But, you know, Jeremiah Wright has to be read as a patriot who's holding America accountable. He ain't trying to hate this. But to see for reference those who ain't patriots, the Bundys. Mm. Right? See for reference all those people with the flag that was waving at the beginning of the Super Bowl. Right? The architecture of white supremacy has not yet been dismantled, and the waving symbols of an aggrandizing resistance to the nation. We ain't trying to secede. We trying to succeed. So I'm saying all those people who hate the nation, who hated the state taking us over, let me shoot them. We don't do that. And I say that to say, this is why it's been painful for me to see Barack Obama misinterpret history in public ways. Black folk, you know, we love him. We forgive him in advance. You know, I talk about forgiveness knowledge in my book.
Right, forgiveness
knowledge. That in advance of what he does that we know is wrong, we forgive him.
We give him a big forgiveness knowledge blank check right at the beginning of his term.
Whatever you got to do to win over, we ain't mad.
Right.
Do it, homie. Do it.
Right.
So if you got to lie a little bit about, you know, Jeremiah Wright, in order to tell a little white lie to get some black truth through, we understand.
Or lie about the structural impact of white supremacy and economics on black bodies.
Right. And if not, lie about it, because if you actually believe it, just be damn wrong about it.
Right.
And we got to be able to say that. And black people have to become mature enough to say, do you want to do the same thing you accuse white people of doing? You say white people go, Thomas Jefferson was great, and he was. Monticello, genius, and he was. Going to Paris and seeing a global structure as it was then, and he did. And then came back home. And many white brothers and sisters find it impossible to believe that he would
rape a 13-year-old girl.
That he would be R. Kelly. Mm. Accused, who was accused, or closer to Philadelphia. So, right? Pull a black man down. Yeah, with the gravity of his own grief and the trauma he imposed. So, so the point is that they can't believe Thomas Jefferson would also be that. But we turn around and we do the same thing in interpreting our figures. Why is it that we can't acknowledge the guy is great? The obstruction has been horrible. The right-wing bigotocracy has tried to kill him. He's got more death threats than any. And in the midst of that, he turned around and lectured and nastily pointed things out about Black America in a way that was devastating. Now, I know, let me take one more minute, and I know we got to go, but to point out to some of our white brothers and sisters and others who may be here who say, well, he keeps talking about, what are we talking about? Before the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington celebration.
That was the worst piece.
My Lord from Zion. Obama stood up and accused Black people of being the reason for the stalled progress of race in America.
That's right.
And I ain't something I heard. I was there, literally. Yeah.
You have the excerpt in here so people can see it for themselves.
I mean, I ain't making it up. Just go read it.
Where he talks about the rioting as being, you know, he doesn't connect the rioting to the history of civil rights. He talks about Black criminality as being responsible for some of the challenges that Black people face. He doesn't acknowledge any of the structural issues or the structural context out of which Black pain and suffering exists in the 21st century.
I can't even say it better. There it is. There it is. That's what he did. Yes, right there. Yeah. Like he said. So, and to do that... Don't tell me.
On that occasion.
On that occasion. Of the occasion of the greatest movement for freedom that Black people have had in the 21st century. Man. Dude, I gotta say I disagree. Man. I got to hold you accountable as much as I can. Man. And I've been dressed down by the White House on many occasions. I've been invited on other occasions. And the point is that we can't allow our personal investment in the greatness of this man to blind us also. And many, because many white brothers and sisters miss that. Mm-hmm. That's nuance. That's over their head. Just like when Beyonce say, I like my baby hair because I like my baby hair. Mm-hmm. White folk, baby hair? Black folk know that baby hair is that little fine. Let's educate our brothers and sisters. A little fine hair that proves our white roots. That we got good hair because we've been told we have anthropologically contour duplicated, that is nappy hair. And so now my baby hair proves, look at my baby hair. Look good, don't it? It's real straight. Right, like white folk got straight hair. And then my baby hair, because ignorant,
they've been attacking her
self-destructive
baby.
Black people
been attacking her
have
child.
Assaulted Beyonce's baby's hair for being natural.
That's
I know a lot of white people, oh, Jiminy Cricket, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Damn, that's what it was?
Yeah.
Yes, that's what it was.
Yeah.
So our own performance of our pathology before the world, parading our ignorance before the world, our president enabled and abetted the crime of misinterpretation and shallow analysis, and he's so much smarter than that. And don't tell me he ain't playing to the white galleys. And don't tell me he ain't trying to tell white people, hey, I can hold these Negroes in check too. At the very moment that Black people are defending him while he's being unfairly assaulted. That is pretty vicious. We ought to say so, and let's not lie. He's still great. He's Shaquille O'Neal with the messed up foul shooter. Right? That's what I said.
Okay, so we are now going to open this up. If you raise your hand, I will call on you and someone will bring you a mic. Yes, sir, back there. Wait for the mic, though, please, because we are recording this.
Thank you. I have another example of white privilege, and that's the election of Barack Obama. It seems to me there's more differences between Barack Obama and Jesse Jackson than just 20 years. The fact that Barack Obama had a white mother, I'm sure, allowed a lot of white people to vote for Barack Obama.
Yes. I mean, he's an authority.
Yes.
He looks like a white guy from here. I'm going to quote him in the future.
Right.
He's first in line. Yeah, I mean, and let me just briefly say this. You're absolutely right, and there are many other ways we could talk about that. Some of his viewpoints have been shaped by it. Because, look, think about it. His grandmama said some stuff he ain't really been honest about. He appointed to it,
right.
But, you know, granny done went off.
Right.
And said some stuff Obama knows. Now, granny, you can't be saying that up in here. Which is why he defended Jeremiah Wright
but
as well.
But he presented a certain kind of blackness. And you talk about this. He presented a more palatable form of blackness to white America.
If you don't love Obama as a black man and you a white person, ain't a Negro been made. You gonna dig.
Right.
Because he is from Central Casting. I mean, wait a minute. Can you imagine? Now, here's a storyteller. I'm a novelist, right?
Right.
You're much better because you're a great English professor. I'm a novelist. let me see, the first black president. Let's make him, okay, tall and good looking. Okay, good. Let's make him have a white mother. Okay, cool. And not just black, but African father to show that he's got... Oh, that's pressing it. That's straining it. That's straining it. And let's make him grow up in the famous black ghetto of Hawaii. Dude, you've lost your mind. We ain't going to sell this. Nobody will greenlight this in Hollywood.
Right.
God greenlit it. And now we've been living the dramatic emphasis in our culture and democracy. I mean, to be real nice, I got to say this. To be as nice as Obama is when people insult him.
Yeah.
Like you know, and if we could be his anger translators, like not this past State of the Union, but the one before, when Obama says, I don't have any more races to run,
yeah.
And then the Republicans start clapping, and he said, because I beat you twice. Well, let me be his anger translator. Look, bitch, what do you want? I whipped your ass twice.
Right.
You ain't got nothing left. You're a poor excuse for a human being.
Right.
I don't know why white people love you, but I'm here as a black savior to reinforce the fact that we still getting it done.
Right.
Got it? Now, that's if that's the black translation of Obama's anger, which is why you should be glad that Obama is president. Even David Brooks today.
David Brooks is
we miss you.
Times. He's like, we miss you, Obama.
Huh?
We miss you already.
I already knew
you
I was
got
miss
Trump
Obama.
Cursing people out from the stops.
I just said this as an imagined Obama translator. That's not my cursing.
Right.
That was Trump's cursing.
That's right.
He actually believed that and said that. I don't curse like that. I'm a preacher.
And he's winning New Hampshire right now.
He's winning New Hampshire now.
He's winning New Hampshire right now.
Oh,
right here in the front. Yes.
So I apologize if you address this in the book. I haven't had a chance to read it. I'm looking forward to it. Everything you've described leads to the next question. What should he be aiming to accomplish in the next chapter? He's probably got 20, 30, hopefully maybe 40 years ahead of him. And I'm asking on two levels. I'm a University of Chicago alum, so I'm wondering if you predict, is he going back to the South Side? Is he, you know, the presidential library will be there? But two, you know, the bigger the national, cultural, and political issues that he should be addressing.
Yes, ma'am. That's a great point. Look.
He'll be in New York, won't he?
He'll be in New York. Yeah. He's a rock star. He's already a rock star. He can go back to being a real, real rock star, making a bunch of money.
Yeah.
You know, it's people. He's going to go to the Supreme Court. No, dog. He got to get paid first.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then he can be, you know, frugal after, you know, $200 million, $300 million.
Right.
Do it the Clinton way. So what's interesting, I'm sorry. I'm down with HRC. Down with HRC.
Right. But that's the truth.
I'm supporting Hillary. You know, I mean, that's what somebody said. I didn't say I was. I'm a neutral media commentator. So, okay. So here's the point. What he's going to do is what Michael Jordan did when they asked Michael Jordan. Speak out. I mean, Michael Jordan was asked when he was at the height of his fame. Could he support Harvey Gantt, who was running for Senate in North Carolina?
Very important race, too.
Very important race. Jesse Helms was a well-known racist. Mm-hmm. So that's, in other words, that's a pass. If you're worried about, oh, man, I got, you know, people looking at me. Look, even white folk would understand you supporting the black dude over against the racist.
Right.
What did Michael Jordan say? I cannot support Harvey Gantt. Why? Because white people buy gym shoes, too.
He said Republicans buy
Republicans buy gym
shoes,
too. Yeah, even more specifically. Yeah. Republicans buy gym shoes, too. So, like, dude, how messed up is that? You got a free pass, and you still didn't do it. Obama's been given so many free passes and still can't take advantage. But then he said, I will speak about race when I'm retired. Nobody gives a damn when you're retired.
Mm.
No disrespect to Obama, but you're no longer president. You're president now. You're giving us what Obama did, essentially, brilliant in terms of his transitional moment, but horrible for the nation in terms of what example it sets for how presidents can engage with social problems. Why make a 503c corporation like my brother's keeper? Basically, you're the head of a charitable organization. Mm. That's not policy. Mm. When you go to Newtown, you didn't say, let's have a kumbaya moment. You put an executive order up there. Mm-hmm. You stood in the White House and cried tears, as he should have, for the children of Newtown. But then he went to Detroit, Michigan the other day, 60 miles up the road from Flint, and couldn't even go to where a vast majority of the people of there who are black and poor reside. You can't cry where you can't go. Being poisoned by their government's negligence, and you are the head of the government. Now, don't be mad at me for saying if you can go to Newtown, you can go to Sandy Hook, and you and Christie, maybe the greatest thing that'll come out of that is that you will sink his potential to be a president. But you can go do all that But you can't stand by the side of citizens who happen to be black and go there and shed a tear for them. So what he will do is, black people will love him and embrace him, and white people, many people in America, will love and celebrate him. He will do extraordinary work. He and his wife will speak, and it will be amazing. But it will be a lost opportunity to enact social policy and public policy, which is what a president should do. But because he was intent on lecturing black people, he didn't go to Iran and say the Iran nuclear deal would be, let's have my Iran brothers and sisters keep her. He had a political project of detente, of de-escalation, of negotiation, of checks and balances and the like. So he will be able, I think, to make an incredible commitment to social change, but I think he's still squandered so much of the potential of that office for the most vulnerable people in America. What was the second part? I want to answer right quick. You were saying, what will he... That was good. Okay.
She wanted to know where he's gonna be, where he's gonna be, and what he's gonna do.
What's he gonna be? He's gonna be in New York.
New York.
Going to see Hamilton for the fifth time.
Yeah. Yes, ma'am. Right here. Yeah. Yes, you.
And then we got to get my man next. I mean, he's been raising his hand right here.
Thank you. I'm going to get the book. This is so enlightening. I want to ask you something that puzzles me and hurts me because I worked very hard to elect this president and I disagreed with him so deeply on immigration, I think to me also involves difference and involves race, and he never saw it never mentioned it in this way, and somehow it hurt me with the people I was trying to bring to vote.
Ma'am. That's a great point again. I mean, when the head of La Raza called him the deporter in chief, right? And now think about this. Maxine Waters cited that, the point you're making, that La Raza, a well-known Latino organization, had criticized the president, and he still didn't go off on Latino brothers and sisters. But he went to the Congressional Black Caucus and said, stop complaining. Take off your bedroom slippers and put on your marching boots. Bruh, when you were knee-high to a tadpole, and these people are out here getting their skulls cracked, they were putting their marching boots on, and you never march for what you now enjoy. So the deporter in chief, the horrible inability to see that as racialized, because he was black, that's where black privilege operated, comparatively speaking. We talk about white privilege, and we should, but we got to talk about the black privilege he got within the community of color to avoid addressing what had a white president done he would have been excoriated for. If a white president had gone to Detroit, if George Bush had gone to an hour outside of New Orleans, and he up there giving a speech talking about how I've revived a certain part of the Gulf Coast with Louisiana, and New Orleans is being buffeted by, you know, the Barrier Islands can't protect it from all of that rain and the wind. They would just dog him forever. They'd be throwing shoes and boots and everything else at him. But Obama gets a pass. And even among communities of color, when Latino people called him out, he didn't have a kind of reprisal against them, but he certainly didn't act as quickly and as powerfully as he might have, and some would argue as he should have, to deal with that issue.
Doc, would you say the two worst holdovers of the Obama administration from the Bush administration is Bush tax cuts, $4 trillion gone, and enforcing the Bush administration's immigration policies?
There's no question about it, except he made it far worse. Yeah. He outstripped Bush. Okay. And then in terms of immigration, then in terms of tax cuts, all the money he wants to look for to help out, you know, social programs that he certainly rightfully put forth are lost right there.
Yeah. We have time for one more. You said you wanted to...
This gentleman has been patient.
Right here in the front here, yeah.
Thank you for coming once again to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you, sir.
I think that Dr. King, if I might say, stands among the giants of American history. So one of the characteristics that I think makes that is he lived his faith. He put his faith into action. Would you chat a bit about the apparent separation from the black church on the part of President Obama?
Yes, sir. No, it's another great point.
You spend a lot of time on this in the book as well.
I do talk about that for sure. You know, and look, Obama's in a tough situation, right? Because the prophetic wing of the black church, of which King was very visible, perhaps the most visible expression. And Jeremiah Wright, his legacy, though often people didn't see that, had already gotten Obama in trouble. So the reason he went to the Apostolic Church in Chicago and delivered that lamentable, regrettable, just downright unfair remonstration against black fathers, mm-hmm. right? That was calculated. He was talking at black people, but he was talking to white America. Mm-hmm. And he was letting them know, watch, I'm going to go up in here in this church at a place of faith and not prophetically articulate a liberating ethic that will allow people to claim their rightful place in American democracy, which is what Dr. King did. He's going to use this as an opportunity to say, you know, making a baby don't make you a man. Any fool, he said, can do that. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm hard-pressed to imagine he would go to a white church and call a white man a fool. Mm-hmm. In fact, when he tried to call a policeman stupid.
Who was acting stupid.
Who was acting stupidly, right? Obama got just chewed out, and we had a beer summit, and that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. No more race talk for years from Obama until Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. So Obama has been caught in a trick bag, as they used to say in the 60s, and in a very difficult situation. 54% of Republicans think Obama is a Muslim. Now, as Jerry Seinfeld will say, not that there's any trouble with that. There's no problem with that. But the reality is this. 54% of Republicans think he's a Muslim. A percentage of Democrats do as well. They don't think he's about 15, right? They don't think he's a real American. So to wear his faith in any challenging way, and it would be difficult. Why do we know this? When Obama stood before the National Prayer Breakfast, not this past one, after he had gone, the day after he had gone to the Muslim temple, finally, to the mosque. Then last year when he said the following, let's get off our high horses and beating up on Muslims. There are other religions that tie together terror and violence mm-hmm. and belief, mm-hmm. like the Ku Klux Klan mm-hmm. and Christianity. And the Middle Ages, the auto da fe, and the Crusades and stuff. People beat Obama down. Oh my God, he's messing up the faith. The right wingers went after him. So, like with race, he's been in an extremely delicate and difficult situation. The church I joined in Washington D.C., Obama came on Easter. Hmm. So he got below the radar black faith. Which is what black faith has been to America in general, below the radar. Mm. You know, when white America discovered that Jeremiah Wright was saying that stuff, I'm like, damn.
Like, what's going
is
on?
Is that what black people be doing in the black church?
That's right.
We thought they were talking about Jesus.
Right.
And these people up here talking about, Mary kiss my ass.
Right.
Man, cussing in the pulpit.
Right.
What the hell is going on?
Right.
Because we had a public that was private. Because of the mass disinterest of white folk and the sheer lack of curiosity about who we are. Mm. See, Ella Baker, there wasn't Ella Baker, it was Fannie Lou Hamer said, the mistake white people made is that they forced us to stand behind them in an inferior position. Mm. But we learned everything we could about white folk. We know when they mad, when they upset, when they do it, and we know how to play them, if I'm not giving out racial secrets. We know how to get a raise. Bob, you look so good today. My God, I was watching Doris Day last night, and I said to myself, I mean, that Velvet Fog Mel Torme, my God, and Henry Fonda, who was better? And Marlon Brando breaks my heart. Look how they massacred my boy. Although they're right on that one. That's the greatest film ever made. Yeah. So black folk had to learn, just like women have to learn men for their survival. Men don't have to learn women for their survival in the same way. In the same way. You better be careful, though. You do have to skillet up against the head. You got to learn that. But I mean in terms of the sheer power of patriarchy and race. So white folk don't have to know black people for their survival. Maybe for their curiosity if they are, but not for their survival. Mm. And black people have to know white America for the survival's sake. So I say all that to say that the black church was able to exist for so long with the blissful indifference of the dominant culture. Mm-hmm. And the Obama presidency, ironically enough, broke that down.
Right. That's
and
right.
that Obama himself couldn't even go to a church because the church would be assumed to be the hotbed for radicalism, or Obama couldn't even freely sit up there and just clap his hands. And he was, now, this was a.
He's sitting straight up.
Sit straight up and can't even, but he was getting it on at our church because, you know, he said, I'm near the end, dog. Thank you. Won't he do it? So he didn't do that. He didn't do that at all. Because he's cool. Leave it in the black church.
Right.
Hey, how are you? Fine. How are you?
Right.
And I'll say this: Obama knows my criticisms and what
he
I've
does.
Said. When he was walking out of church, he didn't know I was at the church. He turned around and saw me, and he went right, and he came and gave me love. Mm-hmm. Now I'm saying that not to say I know the president and show you that you know that already. Mm. I'm saying that as a mark of his profound humanity. Mm. That people who protect him, around him, oh my God. You're doing vicious things. I'm not saying he doesn't feel it at a certain level in his gut, right. but the man performs a graciousness mm-hmm. that is itself a token of his profound Christianity. Because mm-hmm. I ain't interested in what you're talking about. I'm interested in how you're living it. Mm-hmm. And I'd rather be with an atheist who believes in the principles of radical distribution of wealth and love for the other than a Christian who says they believe in my God and they're killing people and lynching folk mm-hmm. and hate Muslims mm-hmm. and Mexicans mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you're right in terms of King's prophetic religion, because King said, I look at some of these white churches and wonder, what God you, who that is? Mm. Who is your God? Mm-hmm. And what does that God mean to us? So in that sense, I think Obama has been an extraordinary Christian at that level. Now, we know he's Pharaoh, not Moses. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that as a judgment. That's a job description. Mm-hmm. He is not Moses. Mm-hmm. He ain't let my people go. He the one you got to turn to let the people go.
Right.
I don't know if you knew that or not.
Right.
So don't expect me to
don't
be spouting no Moses.
Don't confuse the prophet and the politician.
The prophet and the politician. Yeah. I talk about that as well. But yeah. I'm not going to be citing your lyrics.
Right.
You got to come up with your lyrics yourself
yeah.
and challenge me. So at that level, I think Obama has performed an extraordinary service to us by wearing his faith lightly but taking it seriously.
Okay.
And I think at that level, he's done a hell of a job.
Yeah, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dr. Michael Eric Dyson.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.